Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. Happy Monday and President's Day. So maybe you've got the day off today, or Ted, your kid's out of school, right?
Yeah, so, they are. My oldest one's babysitting, so she's entrepreneurial.
Okay, good for her. So she'll have some money she can use for something that she's probably already figured out what it is.
She even has a car fund going already, if you can believe that.
Good for her.
Yeah, it is good.
And is Dad coming along to help?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. You know, eventually, perhaps. Maybe my in-laws.
Okay, sure.
We'll see.
Yes. Well, a happy day after Valentine's Day. So
yeah, you too.
All the candies on sale now.
If you're
interested. All right. Well, we've got a story today that's, it's nothing like Valentine's Day in terms of, flowers and candy, in fact. But it is about love. We're going to talk about a book, a powerful, captivating book called Dangerous Love, A True Story of Tragedy, Faith, and Forgiveness in the Muslim World. And I'm going to introduce the author and the one who's written the story. But first, I wanted just to read you the beginning of the book. This is how it starts, and then we'll jump into the conversation. I knew my chances of survival were almost nil the moment I saw the gun and the expressionless look in the eyes of the turbaned Arab who had stepped out of the sand dunes next to our stationary four-wheel drive vehicle. My panicked thoughts and exploding emotions quickly converged on the survival of my 10-year-old daughter, Hannah, cowering in the seat next to me. When the man turned his aim from my head toward her, something rose up within me that was more than just instinctive protest. No, no, not my daughter. When my wife and I first came to the isolated Islamic Republic of Mauritania, to work among the poor, we asked God to mold us and use our lives in whatever way he saw fit for the sake of those we knew he had called us to serve and love. Over the years, multiple circumstances had caused me to carefully reassess the risks and be reconciled with the fact that this work I loved so much could well cost me my life. But surely that commitment did not include the life of our daughter. The same instant I saw the man aim at Hannah, I threw myself against the window to block the shot and heard the dull, thundering report of the gun as it shattered our world. Glass went flying everywhere. I felt the numbing pain of the bullet as it ripped through my arm, and I heard Hannah scream as she reacted to the chaos and horror of the moment. Before the gunman could take aim again, I slammed the idling car into gear and spun off just as he fired his remaining shots through the rear window into the back of my seat. Once out of range of the gunman and thinking we were out of immediate danger, I turned to Hannah to comfort her and see if she had been wounded by the flying glass shards. But my mounting hope of survival quickly crumbled when I looked her way. Choking back the dark fear that was welling up within me, I reached across her bloodied seat to see why she was clutching the front of her dress. As I pulled my little girl's trembling hands away, I saw in the center of her heaving chest a deep, hollow, and jagged bullet hole, and flowing from it a steady, meandering stream of bright crimson blood. It was then that my already shattered world fell completely apart. Now it goes on, but we're going to let Ray Norman tell the story. Ray is the director for Faith, Leadership, Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene at World Vision International. And he's a former national director of World Vision's program in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania. Previously, he was an academic dean at Messiah College in Pennsylvania. He's a scholar in residence there as well. And he has written this amazing story, Dangerous Love, A True Story of Tragedy, Faith, and Forgiveness in the Muslim World. Ray, first of all, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Neil. Glad to be with you today.
I want to just let you take us back to that moment and kind of give us the setting. You and your 10-year-old daughter are out. You're in Mauritania. What? Just kind of relive that a little bit for us.
Well, Neil, it was the real setting was it was in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. So we were living in an Islamic Republic. Engaged with World Vision's program in trying to help the poorest of the poor in a country where, you know, open witnesses is strictly forbidden. But 9/11 hit as it hit across the world. But being in that Islamic Republic, it ushered in some very unique, if not tenuous, circumstances. So we were all kind of lying low. We were sticking mostly to home and to the offices, and my daughter to her school. And I was alone. I was alone with my daughter in the country. My wife and son had traveled. And after about 5 weeks following 9/11, security measures were lessened a bit. And since we had been kind of stuck at home and office and school, I suggested to my daughter that perhaps we could go out to the beach for a walk or a short swim. And it was en route to the beach that the incident that you just read occurred. So that was really the setting and the context.
Mauritania is what's south of Morocco, right?
That's right. Yeah. It's northwest Africa. It's south of Morocco and north of Senegal. It's the westernmost point of Africa against the Atlantic Ocean.
Much of it desert, right?
Essentially, 90% of it is desert. That's right, with a lot of oases and some mountain ranges, but majority just sand and Saharan desert.
So you were in development work for World Vision. You've been in Muslim countries before, right? Just give us a little bit of your background. I mean, this wasn't the first country that you had to be careful in, I guess, was it?
No. I met my wife in the Republic of Niger, or Niger, as we say it in French, which is another majority Muslim country in Africa, West Africa. I met her there. She was a single lady doing mission work, and I was involved as a professional, as a water engineer. So we met. We both had an interest in working in the Muslim world, and after we were married, we continued in Niger for some time, and our journey also took us to the Middle East and to Egypt and to a number of other places. And I was working most of my at that time. I was working as a professional, as a Christian, but as a working under professional auspices with different, mostly research organizations. And we just over those years, Neil, we grew to love Muslim people. We God really worked a love in our heart for them, and those were deeply fulfilling years.
So you're working in water or agriculture or kind of in Mauritania, and was it all throughout the country, or did you stay kind of mainly in the city?
Well, before going to Mauritania, most of my work was in water and agriculture. I worked a lot with irrigation projects in different parts of the Middle East and Africa. But in Mauritania, World Vision has a very large integrated program, and we worked in multiple sectors. We worked in education, we worked in health, we did work in water, we worked in agriculture. So we were involved in poverty reduction programs that hit a number of sectors, and I was overseeing that program in Mauritania. We had a staff of about 180, most of those nationals, a few expatriates. And we lived in the capital city, Nouakchott, which is on the western coast of the country.
So that day, you're attacked. Your 10-year-old daughter, you're fleeing for your life, literally, with glass and blood and everything. Take us to the next few minutes. What happened then? You were just going out to have a good day at the beach. That changed with a couple of gunshots.
Did. I was looking for some respite and some rest from the tension of the weeks before. And let me also say that a few years prior to 9/11, World Vision had to shut down its program during the Gulf War. Things were also very tense during the Gulf War. And in fact, our staff had to be evacuated because it was just too risky to keep our staff there. So when 9/11 occurred, we wondered if this was going to be we were going to relive the events that we did more or less with the Gulf War. But our hope was to keep the program going because so many, hundreds of thousands of the poorest of the poor depended on World Vision's work in their journey out of poverty. So we were very much hoping to keep the program going, and that's why I stayed in the country with that hope. So when this incident occurred, my world, certainly my personal world, shattered. You know, when I was wounded, and especially when I saw that my daughter was wounded, and it appeared that she was mortally wounded. So my personal world fell apart. But at the same time, I was worried about our work among the poor in World Vision. That perhaps this was also the end of that journey. But of course, during those moments right after the shooting, I was very concerned that perhaps there was other events going on. I did not know if this was part of a concerted effort back in the city, that maybe there was other attacks going on at the same time. Was it even safe to take my daughter back into the town, into the city? Those were the thoughts that were going through my mind. And of course, above all else was, how can I save my daughter? And Neil, I'll add one other thing. One of the challenges was that even that town, the capital city, did not have facilities like we know them here, emergency medical facilities. So I knew that even if I got her back into town, there may be a small clinic, but there was no place that could deal with a bullet in your lung or your heart. And I was feeling pretty hopeless in those moments just after the shooting.
We're going to take an uncomfortable break right here because we want the story to keep going. But you can just try and envision the trauma, the fear, the concerns, all that Ray Norman has going through his mind, and particularly for his 10-year-old daughter. And we're going to hear more about how those things work through, and a number of other important conversations coming up. We're talking Dangerous Love. That's the title of Ray's book, A True Story of Tragedy, Faith, and Forgiveness in the Muslim World. We've got 3 copies of this powerful story to give away, and we'd love to have you sign up for a copy. You can do so by calling 877-933-2484. Whenever we have resources from the publisher, we give them away, do a drawing at the end of the hour. So you can give us a call and talk to Carissa. Give us your contact information. We'll put you in for the drawing at 877-933-2484. And then stick around. Don't want to miss the rest of the story with Ray Norman, who's working with World Vision and has written about his experience in Mauritania. It's called Dangerous Love, and there's more just ahead. Dangerous places in the world, some maybe more than others. The fact is that all of us are not immune to challenges that come our way, but to respond in a loving way, well, that's equally perhaps noteworthy and dangerous. The title of the book we're referencing is called Dangerous Love, A True Story of Tragedy, Faith, and Forgiveness in the Muslim World. Ray Norman is my guest. Ray is a director for Faith, the Leadership, Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene at World Vision. He's the WASH director for World Vision and the former national director for World Vision's program in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania. And as Ray has just introduced the story, we want to kind of pick it up. You're heading back to town of your 10-year-old daughter, and we just want to give you a chance to say that you are well now, but maybe just kind of fill in some of the story in those next few minutes.
Well, when I saw that Hannah had taken a bullet in the chest, it turned out that the same bullet that had gone through the window and through my arm, unknown to me, had in fact hit her in the center of her chest. And so when I turned to her to see what she was doing, to see if she was okay, and I saw that she was in her seat, that was quickly filling with blood, and when I pulled the front of her dress down and saw that the bullet hole, my world just shattered. It crumbled as one would expect when a father sees something like that in his 10-year-old daughter. So I was just I was certainly concerned for our safety, but I thought the best thing was to try to get her back into town as long as town was going to be safe. So I was able to make a call to my office. It was actually some of the staff were still there, and I explained to them what had happened, and I told them that I was concerned that I was going to lose blood and perhaps, you know, not make it back myself, and I was worried about my daughter being stranded there in her condition out in the desert. So I called them and let them know what was happening from my cell phone. And about 20-30 minutes later, I was able to limp back into town, and there was a small clinic run by a French woman just behind our offices. Again, these are not medical facilities like we have in the States, but I remember when we pulled up there, the World Vision office had let the doctor know that we were coming. When I pulled the vehicle up there, the doctor ran out and began examining Hannah, and I remember as soon as she saw the bullet hole, she looked up and gave me a look before my daughter could see what was happening and shook her head very firmly, you know, indicating that she really didn't think my daughter had much of a chance. And, you know, I really cried out to the Lord. I said, Lord, you know, when we came to this country, my wife and I, you know, we had laid our lives on the altar. And if you require our lives, then so be it. But I didn't think that should include my daughter. I said, Lord, my daughter has her own life to live out, her own calling and to follow. And I just asked, I said, Lord, please, you know, spare my daughter. And that was my plea. And then to fast forward, we were able to get her to a functioning X-ray machine in the town. And when the X-ray came out, and Hannah was still, she was still cognizant, she was still alert. Amazingly, there was no bullet lodged in her lungs or her chest. But we saw a bullet down by her waist. And as we rummaged around in the folds of her dress, we found a bullet. And miraculously, what had happened was that when the bullet had gone through the window and then my arm, it had slowed down sufficiently so that when it hit her chest, the bullet actually then bounced off of her sternum and slid across her rib cage and came out in her armpit. So she was not, you know, mortally wounded. She was seriously wounded, but the bullet had not penetrated her lungs or her heart, and so we were. You can just imagine my relief. But she was still, you know, seriously wounded. There was the chance of hemorrhaging on her lungs from the bullet's impact, and they still needed to evacuate her. So, an ambulatory plane was flown in that night, and we were both medevaced to France, to Paris, late that night.
Your wife, I think, was in Paris at the time, or in France at the time, right?
My wife is French, and she was visiting her parents, taking care of some business in France. So when we arrived in France, she took the train to Paris and met up with us in the children's hospital where my daughter was admitted. And Hannah underwent some reconstructive surgery and was kept there for about a week and then discharged.
But you do write about that you know, your wife and son weren't home at the time, so that kind of added to the complication of the aftermath. And, you know, obviously, you know, your wife is feeling a concern that you can't always fully express and what you were feeling as well.
Oh, absolutely. Let me tell you, it was very difficult facing my wife, because when she had left the country, this was after 9/11, when things were still very tense. And I remember when I took her to the airport, she was feeling very uncomfortable with leaving me alone with Hannah, because she sensed that the country was still not very stable, that there were still risks. And in my, you know, male type attitude, as many men will, I kind of downplayed her concerns. But she was right on. You know, what she was sensing was right on. So here I was showing up in Paris with a wound in my own arm and my daughter with a wound in her chest, having to meet up with my wife who had warned us of the dangers. So that was a challenging time. I had to face up to her and admit that her premonitions were right on.
Say a word about, you know, because obviously local governments, Mauritania, get involved, World Vision gets involved. Talk a little bit about what, you know, from a World Vision standpoint, what was their recommendation? Say, well, you're in France, you know, come back to the States, or what do they recommend?
Well, World Vision is involved. World Vision is the largest Christian non-governmental organization working throughout the world. So they have extensive programs in over 100 countries around the world. And, of course, they target the world's most vulnerable people. And Mauritania, of course, is certainly a country that has a lot of very vulnerable people, a very large poor population. And so World Vision's policy in these cases is that the national director, whoever's directing the program in the country, has the final say on whether or not to keep the programs going. And so the challenge here was that the final decision rested on my shoulders. But they were certainly there. World Vision was there to provide counsel and wisdom. And we have a very dedicated security staff that helps us work through these issues. So many people, even people in World Vision, were saying, well, Ray, if we need to shut the program down, then we'll certainly support you in that. But, you know, the decision is yours. But, Neil, what weighed on my heart was we knew that God had called us there. And World Vision's work was very unique. While you cannot witness openly in an Islamic Republic, we were there working with the most vulnerable communities, trying to live out our lives that in some quiet way, you know, that would provoke the questions for which Jesus is the answer. Our constant prayer was that the people would be able to see the love of Christ through our actions, through our work, through the ministry that we had there in trying to help them in their dire circumstances. So what was pulling in my heart was that, you know, now that my daughter was safe, was how can we abandon these people we came to serve? You know, we're there helping them during their difficult times. But then as soon as life gets a little hard or difficult for us, do we pack up our bags and just shake the dust off our feet and leave? And I really didn't feel that this was a good witness. I thought that by just walking out of the country and shutting our program down, that it really would not be the kind of witness we wanted to have among these communities.
Well,
was what I was wrestling with. You know, I didn't want to walk back into immediate danger, but if we wouldn't be walking back to immediate danger, I really wanted to see the programs continue.
Let me break in. We got a quick break coming up, and we're going to hear more about the decision that Ray Norman and family had to make. The dangerous love is the conversation. 877-93. Past the hour, and today we're talking with Ray Norman. Ray is the WASH Director of Faith Leadership at World Vision, former National Director for World Vision's program in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania. And he was previously Academic Dean at Messiah College, Pennsylvania, where he's a scholar in residence. He's written about his experience and his family and the people of Mauritania in the book called Dangerous Love, A True Story of Tragedy, Faith, and Forgiveness in the Muslim World. We do have some copies of the book that we'll give away. So if you've been captivated by the story, as I hope you have, and you will definitely be as you read it, you can sign up for a copy. We'll do a drawing at the end of the hour, 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. Ray, you were talking a little bit about as you wrestle with the decision to return. say a little bit about what was happening in terms of apprehending the shooter, the attacker.
Well, a few days while we were in France, while my daughter was at the hospital in Paris, the attacker was apprehended as he was trying to cross cross into the neighboring country. So we learned that he was apprehended. We also learned that the American embassy had an anonymous call that in which the caller said that, well, we did not get the national director of World Vision this time, but next time we intend to succeed. So that was a pretty threatening circumstances, but at least we were glad to know that the assailant had been apprehended.
Talk about that, you know, knowing kind of what you knew, the embassies involved, you know, your leadership team, you know, family and friends. I mean, it's what kind of advice did you get about you felt like, you know, you were called to Mauritania? How did you decide to return?
Well, it was a very lonely moment for us because, you know, people that we conferred with both at World Vision as well as our own pastors and family members were, you know, they cared about us very deeply and were very concerned for our own personal well-being. And I remember spending long hours on the phone with some of our pastors and other people that we felt accountable to, and often their advice was, well, Ray, you've been working in Muslim countries for, you know, 15 years or so. Perhaps it's time just to hang it up and come home and get restored. Your family needs to be restored back to health, and maybe it's time to step out for a season. And while that was a very attractive notion, in one sense, I just felt that we had made a commitment to the people we were serving, to these Muslim communities, these very poor communities, and that call to serve them and the commitment to continue working with them really pulled at my heart, and it pulled at my wife's heart as well. So at the end of the day, we made the very difficult decision to return and to try to keep the program going. And I'll always remember. I remember when we were flying on the flight back. As we were flying over the desert, I remember thinking, "Well, Lord, you know, I think we're being obedient to your call, but how in the world are we going to get restored? You know, there's no real churches or fellowship or counseling services that can help my wife and my daughter. How is this going to happen?" And I remember when we stepped off the plane, Neil, four large men dressed just like the assailant in their desert garb and their robes and turbans come walking out of the – it was actually a sandstorm was blowing – come walking out of the dark right up to the steps of the plane. And, you know, this was frightening. So I stepped out in front of my daughter, and before I could adequately react, one of these men grabbed my daughter and swept her off of her feet. And it was only then that I saw the tears in their eyes. And these were some of our Mauritanian staff who had traveled from distant places to come and welcome us home. And I remember they swept my daughter off of her feet, and they said, "Hannah, welcome home. Thank you for having the courage to come home." And it was at that moment when we just stepped off the plane that we began to see how God was going to provide for us. And a lot of our restoration, Neil, came because of the love and the help that we received from our Muslim colleagues and friends in the country.
In fact, I'm going to ask you to tell the story about, you know, as you tried to evaluate what you were doing and how the program should go. You actually you had a visit to the local imam. Talk about what prompted that. And
we did, because when I got back, the first thing I had to do was assess the security situation. So I was meeting with government ministers. I was meeting with a lot of officials trying to assess how safe was it to keep our programs going. And it was a very difficult time because I had a lot of contradicting information, you know, some that said things are okay, other information that indicated to the contrary. So I really was pulled in many directions, and I was praying and asking God for wisdom on, Lord, how in the world do I make this decision? So one day I thought, well, you know, maybe I should try to connect with one of the leading Muslim clerics in the country. And I didn't necessarily see this as an answer to my question, but I thought it would be a very wise thing to do. So a week later, to my amazement, this senior cleric agreed to meet with me. We sat down, and I bared my heart. I said, "Sir, we're a Christian organization working in this Islamic Republic. We work with the most vulnerable people, and I'm sure this must be difficult for you to have a Christian organization working among the vulnerable poor, but we do care about them." I said, "The challenge we're having is with 9/11, with the attack on my daughter and myself. My people are telling me perhaps it's time to shut the program down." And I said, "Sir, what's your advice?" I even told him, I said, "My own religious leaders, my own pastors are advising me to come home." And I remember he was very, you know, he wore this long, he was a typical Muslim cleric with this long white robe and white turban and a white beard. And I remember he was silent for a long time, and then he cleared his throat. He said, "Mr. Norman, I think there's three things you need to know." And he said, "First of all, when World Vision staff come into these poor communities, you bring a real sense of order, and I commend you for that. And secondly, your staff are very professional. They're always well trained, and I really commend you for the high quality of World Vision's work in these poor communities." And then he leaned forward and he stuck his finger in my face and wagged his finger. He said, "But Mr. Norman, there's a third thing that I don't think you understand." And I was certain the hatchet was going to fall, that he was going to say, "But, you know, you're Christians and we're Muslims and we really are not compatible." But to my great surprise, he looked at me with his finger still pointed at me, and he said, "What I think you don't understand, Mr. Norman, is that we Muslims, we work with the poor because we're obligated to. It's a commandment. We're commanded to give to the poor." He said, "But you people at World Vision, you work with the poor for another reason. You work with the poor because you love the poor. If for no other reason, stay in our country and please teach our own people how to love their poor." And with those remarkable words, I saw that, in fact, you know, our prayers had been answered, that, in fact, our prayers that Christ's love would be demonstrated through our work was in fact happening, and I heard those words from the leading Muslim cleric in the country.
Because you've, you know, having years working in Muslim, predominantly Muslim countries, I mean, you've had to be careful, right? I mean, and development workers like you and others, just, you know, you don't simply declare your faith openly without some concern, right?
Now, as a Christian organization, World Vision is very open about its Christian identity. We never try to hide that. And in most of the Muslim world, that's profoundly respected. Muslims appreciate it when you're transparent about who you are and why you do what we do. So we were very transparent about being Christian, about our motivation for working with the poor as following the commandments of Jesus to do so. But we did not openly witness. We certainly did not openly proselytize, and you're certainly not allowed to pass out Christian literature. So we had to be very circumspect in that respect.
Do you think there'll be a time, because your experience that you've written so well about, I mean, that there are many development workers that have maybe been, you know, attacked or you know, chased out of countries. Do you think there's a time coming when a Western presence, or at least maybe a perceived Christian presence, will no longer be tolerated in some of these countries?
Well, I think that a lot of that depends on the comportment, on the behavior of Christians who are presently working in these areas. If Christian development workers go in and very blatantly disregard the laws of the land and the promises they make to come into the country, then I think it will cost us. But on the flip side, where Christians are working in these countries and they are, you know, trying to honor the laws of the land, and where they're innovative enough to let their witness take different forms, such as loving the poor, you know, different forms of more quiet witness, I think the opportunities can continue to grow.
Coming up in a moment, Ray Norman will tell about the visit he had with the sister of the attacker and how that started a new step in the journey. We're talking with Ray Norman. Ray directs Faith Leadership, Water, Sanitation, Hygiene, and World Vision International. He's a former director, national director for World Vision's program in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania. And he has written a powerful story in his book, Dangerous Love, a true story of tragedy, faith, and forgiveness in the Muslim world. It's published by Thomas Nelson. We've got some copies to give away. I hope you've been encouraged by the conversation. You would like to read it for yourself. It's a powerful story. And we've got three copies to give away. We'll do a drawing here at the top of the hour. You can sign up with the call at 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. You can sign up for a copy of the book. And you may have a question for Ray as well. Based on what you've heard so far, feel free to join us with your question at 877-93-FAITH. More with Ray Norman in a moment. Past the hour, Ray Norman spent most of his life living in far-flung corners of the globe, working on long-term development projects and living out his calling as a Christian professional. By the time he arrived in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania around the turn of the millennium, he was a veteran of life as an expat. But that all changed in the aftermath of 9/11. He and his daughter had taken a drive to a beach. Instead of spending the afternoon enjoying the waves and the water, father and daughter found themselves hurtling back to the city, each with a bullet hole, pumping blood into the floorboards of their Jeep. And Ray has written about it in the book called Dangerous Love, a true story of tragedy, faith, and forgiveness in the Muslim world. Ray serves in the and leadership at World Vision now for Faith Leadership, Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene at World Vision. And Ray, you, while you're back in Mauritania, you met the sister of the attacker. And talk about that journey.
Well, Neil, when we got back and after meeting with the imam, whose words really helped us seal the decision to stay in the country, the things that were going on in especially my wife's head and heart were related to the attacker. He had been caught, and my wife was very concerned about his well-being and what was going on with him. So she, with her encouragement and her prodding, as well as prodding from my daughter, we were able to actually get an appointment to see the prisoner in the prison. And it was subsequent to that meeting that we actually met his sister. What happened was we were given a very brief appointment. We were told we only had 5 minutes with the prisoner. And we went to see him. My wife prepared a little bag with soap and some towels and some magazines and gave those to the prisoner. And my wife and daughter asked if they could say a few words, and he was posted across the room in the prison. We weren't allowed to get near him. So my daughter, began talking with him, and she said, "Mr. Ali, I want you to know that there's no bitterness in my heart, and I forgive you for what you did." And this was my 10-year-old daughter. We had not coached her. We had no idea. I didn't even know she was going to address the man. And he was flabbergasted by this. He was totally taken back. And I remember him stumbling on his words, and he said, "Well, young lady, those are very generous words." And then my wife, she spoke to the man, and when we were attacked, he started by firing 3 shots at my head that actually misfired before he fired through the window at my arm and at my daughter. And she said, "Mr. Ali, you've probably read the newspaper reports where they're saying that Allah, that God, must have protected my husband when those shots misfired that you fired at his head. Have you read those?" And he said, "Actually, yes, I've seen those articles in the paper. They let me read the paper in the prison." And she said, well, you know, I think maybe there's a different scenario playing out. I think that perhaps, you know, that perhaps God was watching after you. Because, you know, God does care about my husband, but he cares equally for you. And he cares just as much about your well-being and your future. And these words just had a profound impact on Mr. Ali. And so then my wife did the ultimate, which I was shocked me and scared me in a country where Christian literature is not allowed. She walked across the room and stood by him and pulled a Bible out of her purse and began reading passages of hope from Isaiah and then Romans and then ending with John 3:16. And my wife gave the man the Bible, and when she did that, I was convinced that we were going to be locked up in the same cell as the prisoner. And then our meeting was over. And amazingly, the prison director allowed him to keep the Bible. So it was the next day that a woman showed up at my office, and it turned out to be the prisoner's sister. And she said that she had been allowed to see her, you know, her brother that morning, and that he had told the story of our visit and was so moved that he had written a letter for us and had asked her to deliver it. So she had come to the office to deliver it to us, and we kept up a relationship with her for many, many years after that.
He wrote a letter. You also wrote a letter, some time later, and maybe just say a word about that.
Well, he wrote a letter just saying that, you know, many times I wanted to thank you for your visit to the prison yesterday. I was astounded at your words, your kind words. And he said, you know, as a Muslim, I've heard often about this term they call Christian charity, Christian love and kindness. And he said, today, I think I experienced that in the prison when you came to see me. And he was very profoundly moved and wrote a very long and moving letter. A year later, when our time of service to Mauritania had come to closure, before we left the country, we were visiting with the sister, and she made a very interesting request. She said, you know, if you leave here, you're the only people besides me that seem to care about my brother. And she said, as long as he's not a danger to society, would you be willing to write him a letter of pardon? And so we did. We wrote a letter of pardon for him just before we left, and we sent it to the government saying that as long as he's not a public danger to society, you know, don't keep him in prison because of us. And within a year, he was released from prison.
It's an amazing story, and you have seen, you know, God work in pretty miraculous ways, and the leadership of your 10-year-old daughter just in leading the way in forgiveness too. I mean, I'm sure you had to work through that in your own heart and mind, right? Too, do I really forgive this man?
Well, we did, but you know what, the thing that was going on in my heart during most of this was really not anger. You know, when you work in these poor countries where you see so much injustice and so much hopelessness, you can understand some of these people's frustration. It doesn't justify radical acts, but you can understand the desperation that breeds radical acts. So what bothered me worse was more feelings of being hurt by someone I had been called to love rather than feelings of outrage or anger. So I was very grateful to have the opportunity to talk with him and to share where our real heart was.
How can we say more about what's going on, with the organization like World Vision working around the globe, working in relief and development in so many ways? How can we pray for the poor in countries like Mauritania, where there's, obviously Muslim influence, Sharia law, and other places, there's the desperation and the hopelessness. How can we better intercede on behalf of those that are so desperate?
Well, that's Neil. Thank you. That's a very fair. It's a very good and very fair question. You know, World Vision is doing an incredible amount around the world, and especially even in Muslim countries, trying to bring help and to try to bring hope to some of these desperately poor communities. So you can always pray for organizations such as World Vision and others that are doing this kind of work. World Vision is very involved in the Syria response right now. That's a huge crisis. So praying for organizations that are engaged in the Muslim world, that they would have the wisdom to follow Christ's commands in those difficult areas is really important. Another thing I would say is that, especially for the church in America, is I really believe we have to be very careful about this rhetoric of fear that comes across the radio and the TV and other media channels. That we don't respond to the Muslim world in this day and age out of fear. And I really think the church needs to be careful about the way it views Muslims, because we've been given commandment to love. And if we listen to that rhetoric of fear, it can force us, it can cause us to then radicalize the way that we view our Christian witness in the world. And we shouldn't do that. We have to respond in love. And these are people who, for whom Christ died, and we need to love them with the love that he loves them.
Well, you experienced that, didn't you, when you returned, and you know the staff and the just you know friends and neighbors in the community just so appreciative that you and your family would be willing to come back after having experienced that.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, we were recipients of love from Muslim people. They reached out to us warmly. And we had opportunities that we had never had before, Neil. I remember standing up in some town hall meetings, you know, publicly being asked, how, you know, where we hear that your daughter has forgiven the assailant. Tell us, where does the power to forgive come from like this? This is unfamiliar to us. And so it opened up incredible doors of opportunity to sit down and to discuss at a heart level with these people. So we're, in spite of the tragedy, we're deeply grateful for the opportunities that it provided.
You had opportunity to work at Messiah College for a time. So are you still encouraging others to being willing to make those sacrifices to go in some of those maybe dangerous places to serve?
Well, I think if that's where God's calling you, God, when he calls us, he doesn't always promise a rose garden. He asks for obedience. But, you know, we found perhaps most importantly that when we heard God calling us, we heard his voice, but we encountered him. We encountered God's presence. We encountered Jesus's presence most tangibly in the places he called us to and in the most difficult places he called us to. So I often say to people, you know, who are struggling, and they say, you know, where is God in my life? Where is he? He seems distant. And I often ask them, I said, well, are you where he's called you to? Because if you go to where he's called you to, even if it's to the ends of the earth, that's probably where you'll encounter him most tangibly.
Ray Norman is Director for Faith Leadership, Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene at World Vision International. You can find out about all the great work of World Vision at worldvision.org. And I would recommend the book as well. You can get that from Thomas Nelson Publishers. It's called Dangerous Love, A True Story of Tragedy, Faith and Forgiveness in the Muslim World. Ray, thank you for sharing the story so well and for the continued work that you're doing on behalf of World Vision.
Well, thank you, sir. It was a privilege to be with you today.
Ray Norman joining us today on Connecting Faith. This may be a story that you want to pass on to a friend. You know, we post our interviews on our website on the show page after each program, and so you can go to myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page. You'll find the show posted there, and it's all shareable. So pass it on to a friend. Let them be encouraged and challenged, and remember to pray for Ray and the many others that are working in the groups like World Vision, playing a key role in sharing the love of Christ in a very tangible, powerful way. Thanks for listening today on Connecting Faith.